Welcome back to another edition of the ASEP Equal Podcast. I'm your host, as always, Dr. Jason Woods. Our discussion today has become maybe my favorite of all of the podcasts within the ASEP Equal series. We're talking with a pair of people that are both from Emory. Cheryl Hiddleston is director of the Emory EICU, has a Master's of Clinical Nursing Leadership, and is a member of both the Society of Critical Care Medicine and the American Association of Critical Care Nurses. And Dr. Tim Buckman, who is the founding director of the Emory Center for Critical Care and has done previous work on integrating ICUs with clinicians and investigators. They have been involved in an effort at Emory called the EICU, or the Electronic ICU, which is a setup that I hadn't really thought of before, but provides critical care oversight without actually being on site with the patient. Now, I, for one, have not been entirely excited about the telehealth movement just for myself, only because primarily working in the pediatric ER, I just envision myself having to look at a ton of videos and photos of rashes. But they have taken an entirely different approach where they provide both a comprehensive monitoring and data analysis service, as well as online via video and audio support for individual patients and their families. I think it's incredibly interesting how they have gone about this, and you can't argue with the data that they're about to present as far as how effective they are. With that, I'm going to pass things over to Tim and Cheryl to get us started.
We've organized our conversation today around achieving the triple aim in critical care. The triple aim including better outcomes of care, better experience of care, and of course, lower costs. We'll talk to you about how telehealth has enabled this using an advanced IT platform and some business strategy. So this is going to be a sort of dyad and duet with Cheryl and me, and we'll try to get our parts right for you. So I'm going to turn it over to Cheryl and talk a little bit about the United States and Georgia in particular.
So as everyone is probably aware, the United States population is aging. Every day in America, 10,000 Americans turn 65, and that will continue for several more years. We see this also in Georgia. Over the next 8 years, the 65 and over population will increase by 39%, which is actually a greater growth rate than all the other age groups together. We also find that the physician demand for care in the intensive care unit or critical care increases exponentially as patients age. From 65 and especially 85 and older, it doubles in those 20 years. And unfortunately, we don't quite have the number of staff to keep up with this. The physicians available are just not around, especially in the southeastern United States.
Now, this affects the entire United States, of course. The data we're showing here on the right came from a Congress-mandated study that was published about 11 years ago, and the complexity of patients certainly hasn't gotten any less. So with an aging population, and particularly the immigration to the Southeast, people seem to want to leave the Snow Belt and Rust Belt for the Sunshine States, the demand for critical care services continues to rise, and we don't see that changing for the immediate future. Now, one of the problems, of course, is that physicians are not evenly distributed. These data from the AMA master file show the mosaic of critical care physician density, and in Georgia, we're in the middle of the availability zone. Of course, in the Northeast, we have a lot of physicians who want to be in that area, and also in Florida. But there are large sections, particularly through the midsection of the country and the Southeast, where there just simply aren't enough physicians to go around. And we knew that not only was the distribution bad, but the shortage was coming. These data were published by Derek Angus as part of the Compact study in 2000. We in the Southeast, and we know that many others throughout the rest of the country, have difficulty identifying, recruiting, and retaining sufficient numbers of critical care professionals, much less finding ways to get them to work nights, weekends, holidays, unsocial hours.
We also have a very similar problem with nurses in this country, and especially in critical care. There also is a divergence between demand and availability of nursing personnel. The nursing workforce in the hospital is aging, The average age of nurses in an inpatient hospital is around 45 to 50 now. And the number of nurses retiring and leaving nursing will exceed the number of nurses entering the workforce. Less nurses are going to be practicing, and the nurses that are practicing are younger, and they don't have the experience and expertise that the current nurses do.
It's a huge problem. Most of the folks who are retiring now grew up in the era when equipment technology was starting to appear in the ICU. Ventilators that would work on awake patients, use of PA catheters, which although there are fewer, they still are widely used. Those were the years that dialysis came to the ICU. So all that experience and expertise, we're at risk of losing here at Emory. And the nation is also at great risk for loss. Which leads us to the contemporary solution, and that is the use of telehealth for critical care.
Can you give us an idea of what the setup looks like, what kind of staff do you need, and what the technology looks like to get one of these off the ground?
So we have 24/7 nurse staffing in this clinical operations room is what we call it. We have nurses that are 24/7. I have three nurses a shift, and we are covering 100 to 132 beds 24/7. We have intensivists, doctors specializing in critical care, who are there nights, weekends, and holidays. These staff basically serve as sentries. We're doing continuous monitoring for surveillance monitoring to try and catch when a patient is sort of veering off trajectory. We have different data feeds from the bedside monitors and the EMR that give us information, and then there are algorithms developed to alert us when something is happening. The displays and the tools that we have are novel and different from those at the bedside, so that gives us the ability to detect these problems with patients sometimes before the bedside is aware of it.
We serve as air traffic control for the ICU, and just as the screens in front of a pilot flying an airplane are different than the screens that are in front of the air traffic controller, so the displays that we have available to us in the EICU are in some senses quite different from the resources that are available at the bedside.
So we are sentries. We're letting people know what happens. We're advising when there is a problem on what might happen. If the nurses see something and it needs to be escalated to the physician, they will do that. If it's just a matter of notifying the bed staff, they'll do that also. The nurses actually serve as mentors and help with education, just-in-time education when incidences are taking place for the younger nurses at the bedside. The nurses in this area all have a minimum of 5 years experience working in critical care at the bedside. So they've had time to hone their skills and develop the critical thinking that allows them to detect the problems quickly and help if the bedside staff needs help with that. On nights in our area, the average is around 20 years of experience at the bedside. So they're a huge help and support system for the younger nurses that usually end up on the night shift because you have to get a little seniority to end up working on days. So the intensivists actually will consult with affiliate providers at the bedside and the hospitalists and anyone else who might be there in addition to the nurses. At that point, the intensivists will order tests, treatments, interpret the tests when they come back, x-rays, labs, things of that nature, and then they'll counsel and help the staff at the bedside determine the best course to take care of the patient.
I know that we're doing this as an audio, and it might be a little bit difficult to picture this, but can you give us an idea of what these screens look like and what kind of data is available to you that's different from the bedside?
We have a mirror display of the central monitoring station in each ICU that we provide care for. You can actually open up all the individual windows and go and look at exactly what's going on with the patient. A different tool that we use to look at different rhythms for the patient. And then we also have the EMR available to us so we can go in there and look and see what's happening also. If you look at the screen next to that, you'll see We're actually doing a camera session, and we're going in the room to have bidirectional communication with the patient, the family, or the caregiver, whoever we need to speak with.
The ability to get in and actually see the patient, talk with the bedside staff, talk with the families, talk with the nurses, enables a level of telepresence that is virtually identical to what we would have at the bedside. We have sight and sound. We don't have touch.
So it sounds like those that you described are pretty similar to what would be available at the bedside, but perhaps more comprehensive and can get access to all of the different patients. What about any information that you have that relates a little bit more to your traffic control duties? I think one of the most interesting ones was your census view.
Discharge readiness score. That's a census view. That gives us an overall view of all the patients.
I tend to think of this as the type of screen you see in an airport where the flights are listed. So you can go quickly and pick out the flight you're interested in, know what gate it is, what the delays are. It gives you a very high level of information about the population as a whole. But of course, if you're managing large numbers of patients, where you're really interested in is which flights are late. And you want to be able to get information in real time, get alerts in real time that would be smart, that would be sensitive to changes that you can actually intervene on. We have alarms that are completely separate from the alarms that are at the bedside. We have information coming back on new labs that are available and so forth that draw our attention to changing patient conditions. But of course, that's not the entire view that we need. We need to be able to quickly absorb patterns and understand how patients' trajectories might be carrying them into trouble.
So how does your system allow you to do that?
It gives us an overall view of the different patients, and these different orbs or figures have data feeding into them with unique displays that allow us to zero in on specific problem patients. We can also filter it so that we can look at all patients who have problems with their respiratory status or their renal status. And that allows us to kind of, as Tim said, zero in on the patients that are having problems and make sure we're not missing them.
Do you have any data to show how successful this effort has been and whether it's actually gotten at your triple aim of improving health outcomes, improving care experience, and decreasing cost?
When we began our program, we started with a CMS Innovation Award, Healthcare Innovation Award. And there was $1 billion that CMS basically put on the table. There were 3,000 applications for this, these different awards. Only one first round award was in Georgia, and that went to Emory, and Dr. Buckman wrote the program for that.
So we achieved the three triple aims. In terms of better health, we were able to demonstrate in comparison to 9 hospitals in our region caring for similar patients that the introduction of this round-the-clock monitoring and provision of high-level critical care service from an experienced intensivist reduced the mortality rates. But even more importantly, the patients were going home healthier. We saw fewer patients being sent to long-term acute care and nursing homes, and more patients sent directly home and staying home. There was a reduction of the 60-day readmission rates.
We also found better experience of care, and that was exhibited by a reduction in the length of stay for the patients in the hospital. So because we provided consistent care 24/7 and there wasn't a gap in care because there wasn't a physician available, the patients got more consistent care and they got out of the ICU and the hospital sooner. The CMS also sent out surveys to patients and families after they went home. They had a 52% response rate, and they found that our patients and families had higher satisfaction scores. They tended to feel that they were healthier upon discharge, and that the care they received was better.
Now, it's interesting because most surveys that go out, you're lucky to get a 15% response rate. Since this survey was sent out by the federal government, we think the patients and families sort of paid a little more attention. We had about a 55% response rate to the survey. So we're feeling actually pretty good that the data we got actually represented the patient population. But it does come down to money. And what our third-party analysts reported was that If they looked at our federal beneficiaries, that were two-thirds of our total patient population, so I think it's a representative group, every time we touched a federal beneficiary, we saved an estimated $1,486 per episode. Now, you'll remember I said we've cared for about 24,000 patients since inception. So we estimate that the introduction of this program has saved the healthcare system somewhere around $33 million. Not bad for an investment that CMS made in us. They got about a threefold ROI. Now, what's interesting is that there isn't more of this telehealth going on. This is a picture of the southeastern United States, and over on the left are the asterisks where there are currently EICU hubs. Emory is the only EICU provider in Georgia, and if you look carefully, there are none in South Carolina. There are none in Alabama. You see some in South Florida. You see some in Mississippi. And at the extreme western edge of Tennessee, you see an EICU hub. But it's relatively sparse. There are about 50 such hubs in the United States, but the Southeast is underserved.
Now, I know you wanted to give us some examples of a specific hospital that you worked with, which was Statesboro Hospital, about 250 miles south of Atlanta. Can you give us an idea of what their experience was like?
So we have pre-implementation and post-implementation of the EICU program there. Their mortality rates dropped 54%. Their critical care average daily census increased 41%. The transfers from their ICU to an outside facility decreased 30%. That's very important because what this did is it allowed that hospital to retain the patients that lived in that community. They didn't have to be shipped somewhere else. They could stay in their community where their support system is, and that hospital could actually benefit from the revenues that that generated. There was also an increase in the case mix index. The patients they had were sicker, and they, again, were able to keep them. The length of stay went down by a little bit, which means they were, again, the patients were getting consistent care, and they were getting out of the ICE quicker and moving on to the regular floor or to go home. And
the average daily census increased, and all this says that care was made more efficient yet safer. And as you can imagine, for a small hospital, being able to hold on to sicker patients is a crowd pleaser for families because families don't have to move to the big city and set up a domicile and deal with costly parking and confusing signage. It's good for the hospital that we work with because they get to keep sicker patients and use more of their ancillary resources. And at the end of the day, it's good for the state as a whole because it makes use of built rooms that otherwise wouldn't be populated with patients and keeps beds open at the big hospitals so they can deal with patients who can only be cared for at the quaternary center. So this brings us to some concluding remarks about what we do, how we see telehealth, and how we see telehealth contributing to the state of Georgia. And I think the same can be said for many states of the union. The first challenge, as we've discussed, is that there are too few experts for our burgeoning population, our population which is growing not only in numbers but also in age and therefore acuity. And the way we've dealt with this is to use on-site advanced practice providers who are remotely supervised by our critical care experts, our intensivists, and our critical care nurses. What's interesting is that as we built this program, as we mentioned, it's become a haven for older providers who are differently abled. And as such, bringing these people into the environment allows us to meet the increasing demand for immediate access to providers and services. Now, the next thing is unsocial hours, those nights, weekends, and holidays. I don't care where you are. Those are hard shifts to fill.
So what we decided to do was try and find an alternative to having people up all night and working. Tim, Dr. Buckman, actually had a contact on the other side of the world in Sydney, Australia. And we spoke to a university there about a project in which we would move our caregivers there to provide nighttime care in Atlanta from the daytime hours there. We did this for 6 months. So when it was 7 p.m. to 7 a.m. here, it was 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. there. And our caregivers were able to do the same work using the same systems and deliver care to our patients from the daytime hours there.
Now, let's pause a moment and think about what that means. I don't think there are many people who are listening to this webinar who are saying, gee, I'm looking forward to my next night shift. Yeah, there may be a couple, but not many. Most people, given their druthers, would really prefer to work daytime and sleep at night. What we've been able to do with this project of turning night into day and leverage the fact that remote care is remote, it really doesn't matter how remote, is to take care of our staff differently. And we found among the 7 travelers that we sent, the 4 doctors and 3 nurses who traveled, 7 out of 7 actually want to go back and do it again. In fact, one of our nurses who'd been working nights for 3 decades said she didn't realize how much better she felt doing her nighttime care in the daytime and is eagerly awaiting what we're calling night into day version 2.0.
I absolutely love that idea, allowing you to continue to provide great nighttime care to these hospitals that you're serving, but utilize people who are awake during the daytime, improve their quality of life, as well as allow them to work when they're a little bit sharper.
Finally, there's the distance issue. At the end of the day, if you're a patient in the bed, you want rapid access to the best expertise available. And telehealth, the entire industry is built on making distance irrelevant, bringing the expertise directly to the bedside. Now, it might be hard for your emergency physicians to imagine, how could I ever do emergency care when I'm not physically there next to the patient? The truth of the matter is that somebody needs to be there next to the patient. But an enormous amount of what we do involves listening to the patient's story, gathering data, looking at images, and synthesizing all the available information. And I'll tell you, that can be done remotely, and it's done remotely a whole lot better at 3 p.m. than in the presence of the patient at 3 a.m. In short, telehealth, even with emergency and critical care services, has the chance to revolutionize not just the way we deliver care to patients, but also to revolutionize the way we as caregivers manage our own lives. And Cheryl and I will tell you that if you take care of your caregivers and give them different ways to deliver their care, that they feel more fulfilled, more effective, it will show up as better outcomes for the patients. Better care, better experiences of care, and lower costs.
One of the very first questions that comes to my mind is how medical licensing works for this. So to be able to provide care to patients in Georgia from Australia, you had to send your own care providers to Australia. Is that how this is always going to have to be?
As we know, licensure and credentialing is probably the biggest barrier to the implementation of telehealth. The technology has advanced so fast. We're all comfortable FaceTiming our relatives from wherever. The communication is instantaneous. We can move the data and the screens around. Unfortunately, many of the healthcare licensure boards, including the Georgia Composite Medical Board, feels very strongly that anybody delivering care to patients in the state of Georgia needs to be licensed in the state of Georgia. Moreover, our hospitals that we serve, they all have medical staff offices and credentialing committees, and they want to know who's providing care as well. So we had a challenge. We could try to engage Australian professionals and then go through the hurdles of getting them licensed here in the United States, getting them licensed in Georgia, getting them credentialed to all of our hospitals, or we could take the people who were already familiar with our systems, our patients, and our processes and pick them up and move them to the other side of the world.
And what we found going through different legal negotiations back and forth, we hired a team of attorneys in Australia and New South Wales because that's where we were delivering the care. And as long as we were not delivering any care or offering advice on patients in Australia, we didn't have to do any licensure, credentialing,
registration.
Or even registration with the country, because we weren't providing care there.
As long as we don't stay any individual more than six months, they're very happy to have us there, because, of course, while we're there, we're paying taxes on our hotels and our rental cars and going out to eat and using their local services. So we're adding dollars to their local economy.
The longer we talk about this, the more I'm coming to love this idea. But given that we're ASAP, do you see a way forward where this is useful in the emergency department in addition to the ICU?
I think there's an operational way to look at it. Let me move from the ICU to the waiting room of your emergency department and everyone else's emergency department. You can imagine there are 100 patients in your waiting room. And with that 100 patients in your waiting room, the task is to pick out the one or two who actually have the life-threatening problem that isn't obvious. We can all agree that a trauma alert for multiple gunshot wounds to the abdomen, mm-hmm. It's pretty obvious that patient's got a problem. But those in the waiting room who've just walked in off the street or have appeared to be low acuity EMS deliveries, they can be hard to pick out. So the challenge is to take those 100 patients and not identify the one or two, but to embed that one or two in a far smaller population. So if I told you, I can't tell you the one or two patients who got the life-threatening illness, but I can give you 98% probability that those one or two among these six, then you're going to change your search strategy. And I think that's what these tools are about, to call our attention to a subpopulation, not knowing exactly what's going on or knowing for sure that the patient who is flagged is the one that's really in trouble, but to give us the confidence that the one who's in trouble is somewhere among the subset that's been flagged.
That was a perfect answer to that question. That's where we're going to leave it today. Thank you so much for Cheryl and Tim for being here today to talk with us about something that I at least knew nothing about, but I think is going to be a part of our reality going forward as we continue to have to increase efficiency and also new technologies become available to us. And all those listeners out there, thank you so much for giving us your time today. You can find the rest of our ASAP Equal series through the Academic Life in Emergency Medicine feed through Apple Podcasts. You can read our associated blog posts at www.aliem.com. You can find me on Twitter at jwoodsmd or via email at littlepatientsbigmedicine@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening.